Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello and welcome to this podcast. In today's segment, we will be talking with Mr. Chad Lauterbach, the CEO at a leading IT management firm known as the B Structured Technology Group based in Los Angeles. Chad, thanks for your time, and let's go ahead and get started.
Yeah, thank you. Sounds good.
Yeah, can you tell us, we did a Google search on your background, and we looked you up on LinkedIn and everything. Can you tell us the highlights of your career and how you ventured into B Structured? Is it a company that you've helped like create or something? Or
Yeah. So I founded it in 2007, and the way it really happened was I was an IT manager at a transportation company, logistics company in Los Angeles. That was my first gig, and then I was the IT manager for a healthcare startup that went from both these companies went from quite small to pretty large. So the logistics company I was employee like 12, and it went to about 150 before I left. And then the healthcare company went from, I was about employee 10 or so, and went to about 250 people before I left. And you know, one of the kind of fun things about IT is you can kind of moonlight, right? So those were my day jobs, and then on the weekends and evenings I would help other small companies, you know, companies that were 10 to 30, 50 people, just to get stuff done. But you know, it's hard because I wasn't available during the days, and I couldn't fully meet their requirements and needs. And you know, these companies I were working for had, you know, decent size IT budgets. I usually had I had a second staff person, and you know, we had servers and all that kind of jazz. And this was back in the, late 90s, early 2000s. So, you know, everything was on-premise back then. There was no cloud and all this kind of stuff. But, I couldn't fully meet their requirements. And so I knew I wanted to leave the healthcare company for various reasons. And so rather than just going and getting another job, I kind of built a base of a few customers moonlighting, you know, evenings and weekends. So I went to them and just said, hey, would you be willing to sign a contract with me to do your IT stuff on a more regular basis? And they pretty much, I think all of them agreed. And it was only like four clients, but it was enough that even though I had to take a small pay cut, you know, I was ultimately able to launch B Structured. So, you know, I had kind of this platform already built to be able to launch B Structured, and technically I started doing it in 2006, but I incorporated in 2007. So that's usually what I call its birth date is 2007. And I've been doing it ever since. We've been growing and picking up larger clients and picking up more clients. And we have 13 staff people now total. I think that's including myself. And we service a lot of small to mid-sized companies, anywhere from between, you know, 8 people to 200 plus person shops and anywhere in between. You know, I'd say our sweet spot's probably like 50 to 100 employees. That tends to be the size company that they really need legitimate IT services, but we can come in and do a better job for less money than they could build out a department themselves. So the value proposition kind of in that, I don't know, maybe like 30 to 100 people, 30 to 150 people, that's really our sweet spot just because the value proposition is really there.
Cool. So it sounds like the SMBs are more or less your target market, if I'm correct.
Yep, that's right. Yep.
Oh, excellent. Now, how long has your company been in business?
Well, so, yeah, like I said, 2006 is when I started kind of on my own, but technically I incorporated in 2007, so that would make it 12 years old as of January this year. So, yeah.
Okay. Right. Yeah, congratulations. Now, one thing when I interview cybersecurity executives just like yourself when they start, you know, their companies, one thing that always intrigues me is about their name. Like how they got their name and how what was the process behind that? So if you don't mind, how did you get the name B Structured Technology?
Yeah, you know, not a lot of people ask that question. I it's funny you ask it because I had one sales call recently where somebody asked that question, but very rarely do people think about it. But I appreciate the question. That's a good question. So originally the name was Structured Information Services, Inc. That was the name that was incorporated in 2007 when we were really, really small, just starting out. And I like the word structured. You know, I was just looking for some sort of word to pin the name on, right? And I didn't want it to be a too cumbersome of a word. And personally and professionally, I'm a very organized person. So, you know, I like my I live by my calendar. You know, I'm still old school and file all my emails. I don't use Gmail and search and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, I'm very just meticulous in my organization, and just that's just kind of the person I am. So to me, that came out as being structured, right? Like I'm kind of a structured individual, and that carries over into my work life. So I like things to be very structured and set up. So structured just felt like the right word to embody kind of what the company was. But the problem was information services isn't really what we do. We do information technology, really. So,
right.
You know, I recognized the problem with the name shortly, you know, within a few years. And as we grew, I recognized, like, I had no idea what I was doing with marketing. I had, like, a friend make the logo and, like, you know, all the typical mistakes a small business owner starting out makes, I made. So I went to a marketing firm, and I just said, look, I want to rebrand the company into – I want to find a brand that I really like that's permanent. And we threw out literally hundreds of names, including complete name changes, which would have been okay at our size at the time. I think this was back in 2010, if I remember right. And everybody kind of liked the word structured. Like, everybody felt like it did embody the firm and embodied me. So well, the part we wanted to get rid of was the information services. So then it started to become a domain name search. So it was like, what domain names can we be? And one of the guys had an idea, like, what if we can just tack on some sort of word? Because obviously structured.com is gone. I don't know who has it, but it's not available. So we literally took a list of like 100 words. Like, I can't even remember. I probably have an Excel spreadsheet with them. It was like go structured, be structured. Oh, wow. You know, like we had like a zillion permutations, and then we got it down to what domain names are available, and there may be like 20 left. And honestly, everybody just liked Be Structured. Like, it was just everybody's favorite. Because it was like, they felt like from a branding perspective, you could have, like, you know, being structured makes sense, right? So, like, Be Structured is, it keeps that embodiment of the concept of having a structured information technology system and having organization and structure around your systems. But it allowed us to also think about branding, like, Be structured, get structured, get structured could be a sales idea, like, so get structured, be structured, stay structured, right? So we had this idea that you could tack on kind of any word to the front and kind of build other marketing resources around that concept. So that's where the name came from. It was really kind of a rebranding of that original structured word, but a bad name. So
gotcha. Yeah, I mean, I like the name, too. I think, you know, in cybersecurity, we need to have a structured approach. So, you know, I mean, everything's so chaotic right now, you know. And I like that, you know, like, you know, that you're taking a structured approach for your clients.
Yeah,
now,
thank you.
Now, Be Structured is based out of L.A., right? I mean, do you serve other
That's
parts
correct.
Of Los Angeles or just downtown? Or what are your geographic areas?
Yeah, one of the kind of funny things about Los Angeles is people care more about drive times than they do distances. So, and I get that. You know, customers are concerned with, for example, like Santa Monica or Malibu, those are areas that are very difficult to get to. They just take a lot of time to get there. They're not difficult and like difficult to look up Google Maps, but they're hard to get to. They take time. So from downtown to get to Malibu can oftentimes be in excess of an hour. So it's difficult for us to land clients in Malibu because they say, well, you know, if we have an emergency, it's going to take you at least an hour just to get here. And so I get that from a customer perspective. So while I would say we generally speaking service all of LA County, it's much easier for us to go east than west. So the further west we go, the harder it can be for us to land clients in that direction. Whereas the further east we go, we can go pretty far east and people are less concerned because the drive time is not as bad. Because you're going so much faster, going 30 or 40 miles is not that big of a deal. So, you know, we have clients that are not even based in LA. We have clients that have, you know, branch offices or headquarters even in other cities and states. So Florida, Colorado, New York, Washington, et cetera. So we have stuff all over the place. But generally speaking, I'd say it's kind of a 20-mile radius or so around downtown Los Angeles, which would include kind of North Orange County, something like that.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I've been to Los Angeles. Actually, I mean, like I haven't been there, but I've flown through LAX. I think it's a huge airport. I think my best memories of LA are like on the when O.J. Simpson, you know, when they were traveling to catch him. I think I won't. That's probably the best way I remember LA. But that
right.
Topic. Yeah. Okay. Now we've talked about your typical customer base, or the SMBs. So what industries do you target within that group?
Sure. We don't really have a vertical focus. I mean, there's some verticals that I would say tend to – I guess I would say it this way. There are some verticals we tend to avoid because they don't fit into our model very well. We tend to be more of a B2B servicing company. So – you know, certain businesses wouldn't really be in our portfolio, like a hospital, right? That's 24/7, 365, has really unique requirements. A hotel would even have similar requirements. So there's some industries we, I would say, kind of avoid. Or, you know, we don't really do POS systems, so like anything that involves like direct retail sales, we don't really get into just because it's not an expertise of ours. So we're very horizontal within the B2B space. So we have clients that are wealth management, law firms, financial service firms, but it ranges even into the industrial. We have an industrial food manufacturer. We have an industrial chemicals manufacturer. We have two industrial chemical manufacturers, interestingly enough. We have a couple transportation companies that come part of, that kind of come out of some of my old relationships in the transportation industry. So it's pretty horizontal. So I'd say there's more like, there tends to be more organizations that just aren't a fit for us. And, you know, they don't often contact us. You know, I think most of the time, if you're in hospitality or you're in retail or you're in healthcare, a lot of times your initiating point of contact is like, I need a POS system, or I need an electronic medical records and practice management system. And then that trickles down to finding an IT service provider versus a business that just does some random business thing like, oh, we do business leasing. Okay, cool. You know, they oftentimes are using pretty off-the-shelf standard systems like Microsoft Dynamics, SharePoint, Office 365, et cetera. And they know exactly, they just need an IT service provider to do help desk support, manage these systems, monitor these systems, backup these systems, et cetera. So those tend to be the leads we get too.
Okay, excellent. Yeah, it seems like B-Structured, you know, when I start a website, it's a full-service firm. I mean, you do everything from IT consulting to virtual CIO to data backup, VoIP cloud backup, and network security. Can you kind of elaborate more on those and, like, what your sweet spot is in those four groupings?
Yeah, we again, you know, things get interesting into those areas, like you said. The reason we market to some of those specific areas is our sweet spot is a little bit hard to define because it's not hard to define. It's just it's all of that. So our sweet spot, our very best customer relationships are in all the ones I kind of just described there, our wealth management company, our industrial chemical, our food, you know, client, et cetera, et cetera. These are companies we do everything for. So we do VCIO, backup disaster recovery, oftentimes do VoIP, oftentimes manage their Office 365 environment. You know, we may even have an on-site employee. We do, you know, we do help desk. We do all of it, soup to nuts. So we become their IT department and then end up providing some of these other services. So those are our best relationships. That being said, one of the reasons we market specific services on the website, like VoIP, is VoIP is something that's really easy for us to do independently. Or Office 365 is very easy for us to do independently. Or backup disaster recovery is something easy for us to do independently. So, like, we have some BDR-only customers, right? So they have an IT department, but they don't want to deal with BDR. So they come to us, buy a BDR solution, and that's all we do for them. Same with, like, VoIP, video surveillance, what am I thinking about? Oh, access control. We actually haven't even – the webpage for that's going up this week, but we do – like, a lot of the access control stuff, so doors and locks and stuff like that, has all become IP-based, and the locksmiths totally hate us. But, you know, we're coming in and doing access control, and we're subcontracting out the actual locksmithing part because that's not really in our wheelhouse, like changing out the actual door hardware, right? That's not an IT person's job. But once the door hardware is in there, it's all just like – it's all a computer program at this point, cards, servers, access control. So, you know, we're kind of taking that job away from them. And then all the surveillance stuff now is becoming IP-based. So, you know, unless people have very, very specific and unique requirements, like maybe an airport or something would, you know, we have great surveillance stuff that's available at a lower cost than people can traditionally get from those systems. So, you know, our food manufacturing company, as an example, they're building out a new facility, and they've spent tons of money on video surveillance in the past. They're going to go with us because we can come in so much cheaper and do a good job. You know, it's nice equipment. You know, it's maybe not these 8-megapixel being able to zoom in on a license plate from 300 yards or whatever. But, you know, if you don't have these very, very unique requirements and your requirements are more general, like I want 4K video monitoring the floor where we make pizzas or whatever, you know, that's something that we can accomplish and accomplish at a lower price. And then it's all integrated and converged and people like that. So, and again, you know, that's something that we could do isolated, right? We could do a video surveillance deployment for a company and not do anything else. So, you know, where the website kind of markets individual services tends to be areas where we're comfortable coming in and only doing that. But again, our best customers and our best relationships are those where we do everything soup to nuts. We are their IT department, so it would include all those services.
Excellent. Now, are your solutions, I mean, can they be on-prem, or are they mostly in the cloud, or can it be both? Or,
you know, that's a great question. That's a question a lot of customers ask, too. A lot of our legacy customers have on-premise stuff, especially older businesses that have been in business for a long time. Again, a lot of the ones I've said that are our larger clients, they have custom or just older systems or solutions that are on-premise and really require an on-premise. It would be more expensive to try to deploy them in the cloud. So what I kind of find is, like, our youngest companies are companies that have only been in business for 10 or fewer years tend to be 100% cloud. And our customers that have been in business longer than 10 years tend to be most of them are hybrid at this point, I would say. I'd say that I don't know if we have any clients that are absolutely 100% on-premise anymore. So to give you an example, you know, a client might, like a lot of our clients, most of our clients have some sort of server presence on site. Could be a file and print server, could be a specialized old application they use for computer-aided modeling, or who knows what. You know, there's some requirement for something on-premise, but then everybody's running Google Apps or Office 365. Everybody's running Slack or some other, you know, communication program that's in the cloud. So virtually all of our clients have some cloud assets. So I call it the hybrid cloud. And I think we're going to continue to live in this hybrid cloud world for an extended period of time. You know, I think businesses can be 100% cloud, but it doesn't always make sense yet. You know, I think there's going to be quite a bit of time still here where a lot of businesses have something on-premise, especially the larger or legacy ones, where it's going to take a long time for them to move to 100% cloud.
It's interesting you say that because I think you're the first person that I, you know, with such a deep background that you have that's actually kind of advocating a mixture of both. You know, that's interesting because everybody's kind of advocating cloud, and I'm kind of a big staunch supporter of the cloud too. So it's very interesting that you would say that. I think it's very unique. Now, I just kind of want to backtrack. You had mentioned like a lock and key approach, I think, in one of the other previous questions. Have you ever come across the maybe biometric technology like hand readers or fingerprint readers in that regard for like physical access entry? I was just kind of curious.
Yeah, we have. We haven't had all basically anything with these systems is possible. You know, they've all okay. become the two systems we use. They support all of it, right? So they support hand scanners, retinal scanners, fingerprint scanners being kind of the cheapest and most common, but we haven't had a client have a specific need or use case for them. You know, for the most part, our clients are just using cards, right? So it's more a replacement for keys. So like a great example would be one of our clients is a small college, right? So, but they do have dorms and, you know, they have offices and classrooms and all that kind of stuff. And they needed access control. And so they've dealt with in the past keys, right? Their old campus was keys. And not only is it expensive, but it's a pain in the butt, right? If you have to rekey something, it's a pain. It's, you know, if you run out of keys or don't have the right key or whatever, you're calling locksmiths and you're paying $100, $200, $300 for a service call, whatever. You know, with these programs, they don't even have to reach out to us, right? Once it's installed, they can just log on to the platform and say, this access card has access to this room or doesn't. So because it becomes unique to that user. So, you know, these aren't necessarily like super high security, locations. They're not data centers or airports or, you know, hospitals or anything like that where biometrics is required. So it wouldn't be difficult for us to do that stuff. It's not hard to integrate a biometric aspect to what we're doing. We just haven't had a client with a need, and it does cost money, right? So if you don't have the need and it costs money, people tend to not spend the money. So
sure. Okay. Now obviously there's a ton of IT support services companies. I'm sure LA's got a huge pack of them. In fact, I work for an IT support services company here too in Naperville, Illinois. Why should customers say, hey, Chad, I want to come to you first versus these 20 others? What makes it different from the others?
Yeah, well, I wish there was only 20 others. You know, LA is a very, obviously it's the second biggest city in the country. It's the second biggest metropolitan area in the country. That's one of the reasons I think locality is a big deal for people. So, probably not dissimilar from like New York, not that dissimilar from me from like an Illinois and Chicago area. You know, if you're in downtown Chicago, you're probably going to look for an IT service provider that's based in the downtown area, right? You're probably not going to look for an IT service provider in Naperville, right? Whereas Naperville probably can cover a very vast area of that suburban part of Chicagoland, right? So, yeah, I would think the same thing with New York. If you had a business in Brooklyn, I can't imagine you're going to look for an IT service provider in Manhattan, right? You're going to look for an IT service provider in Brooklyn. So LA's very similar in that. And so, you know, LA County is a pretty vast area. And, you know, we're one of only a few shops in downtown LA, shockingly. So for downtown LA folks, you know, we're an obvious choice, right? Like if you have a small to medium sized business in downtown LA, we're one of I think three firms that are legitimate, that are of any sort of scale. And some of my competitors have like Regis mailing addresses in downtown LA that they post on their website to try to pretend they have a presence. Drives me insane. So to try to pretend they have a presence in downtown, but they don't have anybody in downtown. All of our people are in downtown LA. So that's something I always have to explain to people, like, we can walk to your office. And that's a strategic advantage to us. So for people in downtown, that's really compelling, right? We can walk to your office in 10 minutes versus get in the car and drive for 45 minutes like you can other places in LA. So, you know, again, the geography and kind of the driving aspect of it is a unique thing. So, again, going kind of like north and going east tends to be very easy from downtown, and going south. Going west is always the big deal in L.A. West side L.A. is just harder to get to. So, like, a Santa Monica firm very well may Google search Santa Monica IT support or Santa Monica MSP versus Los Angeles. So even though they're in L.A. County, they're definitely a part of Los Angeles. People think of the Santa Monica Pier and think of Santa Monica when they think of Los Angeles. You know, they're probably more likely to not even look for us, right? So, so I don't know. It's a little hard to say. So one part of it is geography. But I think you're asking more specifically, like, what's our unique selling proposition? The LA market is very fractured. So there's probably five, maybe a few more. I mean, I know a lot of the MSPs in town. There's probably 5 to 10 fairly large MSPs. When I say fairly large, I'd say like 50 to 250 person shops, right? So pretty big shops. So, but there's only a handful of them, and none of them are in downtown. A lot of them tend to be in the Valley for some reason. I don't know why the Valley is so compelling, but a lot of them are in the San Fernando Valley area. One of them's down by the airport. But so there's a few really, really big shops. The advantage, obviously, with the really big shops is they have a really deep bench. The disadvantage of these really big shops is they don't have the same TLC that a smaller shop does, right? You're just another sale to them. You're just another number. The CEO tends to not be involved in the day-to-day aspects of the business, tends to not be involved in your account. So you're going to have like an account manager. And I get it. When you get to that scale, you have to function that way. The CEO can't be involved in every single account and client. That's just too much. Whereas, and also in LA, you have a ton of, just tons of really small shops, right? 1 to 5 person IT shops. So those guys tend to just be too small for a lot of firms, right? A 100-person company is going to have a hard time relying on a 2 or 3-person shop. They're going to feel uncomfortable with their skill set, the depth of their bench, their ability to provide support, et cetera. So, you know, I'd put us on kind of the small side of a mid-sized IT company, but, like, there's probably 30 MSPs in LA that are 15 to 30 employees, and we're kind of right in there. And to me, I think the advantage of working with a mid-sized IT service company like us or one of our competitors, although I hope you would work with us, is that you get that extra TLC. And I think one of the biggest differentiators between us and our competitors in our size is that I'm technical. So what I've seen with a lot of our competitors, and I know some of them I won't name names, obviously, but like the CEOs tend to be business guys, and they're doing sales and doing revenue generation. Well, a different guy on our team does revenue generation. I don't do it. I'm not that great at it. I like the tech stuff. So I like getting in the weeds and doing the technical work. I like having technical conversations. When I walk into a shop, I can assess their needs more quickly. I can have a conversation with them about technology that a lot of times other CEOs at these mid-sized companies that are just trying to land the sale can't have. So I think that's one of the big advantages for us is that we're really a tech-driven MSP. You know, we understand the technology and driving the technology.
Oh, excellent. Yeah. Well, we'll talk about the Regis address because I'm using two of them right now, too, so in all honesty.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah.
It makes a good address, so I got to be honest with you. But anyway, this is kind of changed topics here.
Yeah.
Now, do you offer any free trials or any free risk assessments for your customers before you onboard them as a real customer?
Yeah, we do offer it, although I'll be honest, a lot of times it doesn't come up. You know, people, and I don't know if that's just unique to us or what, because I see a lot of our competitors offering like free network assessments and that sort of thing, and we've done them before, but it's rare. You know, a lot of times once we come in and meet with them, they just want to start talking about their requirements, what's not working with their current stuff, you know, what they have. And a lot of times, the assessment becomes a conversation more than it becomes about doing a technical assessment per se. You know, or a lot of times I can just walk in the server room with them and say, oh, I can see you have these are new, these look really nice, when did you install these? Oh, wow, these look old, you know, what's going on with these? And you know, almost have like a live consultation. And again, that's kind of different about the sales process with us, I think. And maybe part of the reason for that is that I am technical, right? Like I can walk into a room and be like, oh, you have a PowerVault yada yada. That's, you know, are you using iSCSI? You know, oh, cool. Okay, how are you configuring that? And, you know, so because part of the sales process is like me and our, you know, our rev guy going out and we know the technology, we don't have to be like, hey, let us send a network engineer out to do an assessment, right? We can do so much live because I already know the technology. So it's not like there's a sales guy coming out just trying to say like, hey, let us do a free network assessment. You know, I can kind of do a lot live in the room with people that I think a lot of other CEOs just can't do, and they have to send a network engineer out to do.
Excellent. Okay. I've never heard about that approach before. It's very unique.
I wouldn't even say it's an approach that we've been like strategic about per se. I feel like that's just what happens. Like, you know, we offer these free network assessments and then people are like, well, why didn't you come in and meet with me? And we're like, yeah, that's great. We'd love to have a meeting. And then the network assessment just never happens because they just feel comfortable after they've had a conversation about their needs and we talk about it. They're like, well, you know, you just told me half, you know, 80% of what I need to know. Like, what am I going to learn from a network assessment? And it's kind of like, yeah, the network assessment is going to let us do a deep dive on how the equipment's configured, but modifying that configuration after we get in there anyways is probably not a big deal. And it doesn't seem to be what people care about the most. You know, I think what they care about is demonstrating competency. And because I'm already demonstrating competency in the room, I think they're content with me demonstrating competency and at that point don't care about the network assessment. So
it's interesting you bring that up because, I mean, and I think in security, cybersecurity, I think people just want to hear things straight up front and direct. There's so much of the employees out there. In fact, even for my, you know, I'll even put a little bit of plug in here too, even for my thing, you know, being .NET and cybersecurity, you know, the way I position myself is that, you know, hey, we tell you the cyber threat landscape the way it is, and here are the tips and non-techno jargon. I think people find that so refreshing these days. I mean, especially in cybersecurity, there's just so much noise out there, you know. And you know, everybody uses all big words, you know, like, you know, mean timing detection, you know, attribution. What does all this mean to a person, you know? What does it mean to an everyday consumer? But yeah, that's really refreshing. You're the first person that I've actually heard say that. That's the approach that I'm trying to take too. Just keep things simple and keep it the way that people just want to hear it the first time. You know, there's no need to show all these fancy dashboards and analytics and graphs. It's just too much.
Right, like, oh, here's a Nessus external penetration test report. Well, to the client, like, they look at that. I mean, I'm sure you know what that is. And it's like, to the client. To the client, it's like, you have to explain this to me, right? I don't know what any of this stuff means. And yeah, it's just like, yeah, I get it. Like, that's something that we would do after we onboard you, and then we'd plug the holes, right? Versus like, yeah, let me do this network pen test just to scare you into buying something from me, I feel like is what a lot of firms are trying to do, right? And I think I'm with you. I'm like, I would rather have an honest conversation with people and talk about their real needs and their real desires and their real concerns and go from there. And that tends to not be that technical. It, like, that's just too technical for them. So,
well, it's information overload. And I mean, we are so much saturated with technology, digital media. It's like, even my brain, see, I work full-time during the day, and even my brain just gets so overloaded with all this techno jargon, techno terms, you know, it's just, you know, enough's enough. You know, I just kind of relish days. We just, you know, go back to the 1980s, you know, when I went to high school and college, and, you know, just use a simple landline phone, leave a message, hey, mom, take me from school, you know, it's just, I really wish those days would kind of come back. I mean, it's just, I mean, I'm coming to the point now, I mean, where I'm getting kind of burned out technology, to be honest. You know, I've been doing this for a long time, but I mean, we are just so much saturated with all this nonsense on social media, this, that. It's just really, it's too much for the brain to handle, especially mine, I guess. Anyway.
Yeah, totally
now,
agree.
Now, do you provide any authentication services? I know in cybersecurity managed services, 2FA, two-factor authentication is a big buzzword now. But I'm finding that people are just doing, that's not enough. People are now talking about multi-layered authentication. So explain that. I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, my thought is, you know, it's absolutely critical. And do we do it internally at our firm? Absolutely. One of the things that's been really challenging has been getting customers to buy it. You know, it's interesting. Once a customer has some sort of attack, they're willing to spend any amount of money, right? So if they've had ransomware or they've had, you know, any sort of direct or indirect attack or threat happen or lost some data or whatever, now it's like, okay, what's it going to cost? $1,000 a month? I don't care. Fine. Do it. Whatever. But it's just such a hard sell up front. It's like, you know, I tell people it's a little bit like imperfect insurance. So it's insurance that is likely to protect you, but nothing is 100% in the security landscape. Right. So, but it's really important insurance. Like, it's 2FA is not an option anymore, in my opinion. That being said, I really wish we had more of our clients rolled out with some sort of two-factor authentication. We just met with one of our clients the other day, and it was like pulling teeth. They just want to do it the cheapest possible way, or they don't want to do it at all. And even when we explain the risks and the issues, you know, it's very, very difficult. I mean, one of them's even in financial services, and I don't know why it's such a challenge, but it really is a challenge. So, you know, we generally use two services. One of them is Duo, which you're probably familiar with. They're pretty big. We really like that. We've used YubiKey and from Yubico in a small way. I think their stuff is super cool and super powerful. I think for a lot of users, it's a little bit too much, a little bit too tricky. Duo is nice because it's just so simple, and it does solve the problem. I think it solves it in a pretty unique and cool way. The push authentication is pretty cool. We have a lot of clients that just want to do free TOTP auth, which at the very least we can do for some stuff, right? We can do Google Apps or Office 365, Slack. You know, a lot of their cloud services, we can do TOTP. And it's essentially no cost, so, you know, except for our labor to set it up. So we've had a lot of clients doing that, but the only problem I see with TOTP is that not 100% of things are covered. So, you know, their Active Directory authentication, if they have local or any sort of on-premise stuff, might not be included depending on how their network is configured. So I still see a problem with TOTP, not in and of itself per se, even though it's not the strongest two-factor authentication out there. It's certainly better than nothing, but it tends to not be 100% coverage, whereas with like Duo, we can tend to get 100% coverage on people, which is really good. But I'm 100% for it, and still we have a hard time getting all of our customers on board with it. So that's a big push for 2019. Is we actually have a new kind of branded security program that we have. It's not branded on the website, but it's like a branded brochure type thing that we're sending out because we're trying to simplify it for people to really understand like how important this is and why you need to spend the money on it. Because, you know, Duo costs us money. We can't give it away for free. You know, I almost would if I could, because I know how important it is, but we can't. We can't give it away for free. It costs us money, and it costs time and labor to set it up. They have to pay something for it. And, you know, that's been one of the conversations. It's like, well, why can't you just do it? Well, because it actually literally costs us money. We have to charge you for it. So, but, yeah, I'm a huge proponent of 2FA. We do it internally. We have other clients that do it, and we're making a big push to get our clients on board with it.
Yeah, I hear you on the authentication services, you know, selling that, because, I mean, it just seems like as an American society, we're still kind of like naive. You know, we won't react until we're hit first. And I can kind of see that, but at the same time, we got to be proactive too, because, I mean, once we're hit, I mean, we could be hit over and over again. You know, and it's your bottom line that's impacted. So, I mean, I've written a lot about that. And I really hear you on that. I just wish as a society we were a lot more proactive about that. I mean, I see, for example, biometrics. I mean, just to kind of relate back to that again, like here is in this country, we are just so slow to understand the benefits of it. I'm not saying that biometrics is like the cure-all for everything, but, I mean, there are countries like in the poorest of poor regions, like in Afghanistan, they're using iris recognition. You know, and even in Africa, they're using, like, iris recognition at airports and all that. And it's like, how can we can't do something here like that? You know, it just stimulates the mind. I think it's more of a psychological question than really, you know, than more of a technical question. But that's something I've always kind of wrestled with.
It's interesting you bring that up. I don't want to go too far off the rails, but I have a little bit of a theory about that. So I'll just. I think you would find this interesting, and maybe some of the listeners would find this interesting too. You know, I think because the United States of America was kind of founded on this idea of liberty and freedom, you know, fair search and seizure and all this kind of, you know, a lot of the stuff that's in the Constitution and Bill of Rights, I think we have this heightened view of, and maybe rightly so, I think we have this heightened view of privacy, even above that of Europe, which is ironic because they just launched, you know, GDPR and all this other kind of privacy-related stuff. But, you know, Europe is putting privacy on – they're putting the onus of privacy on corporations. And I feel like in the U.S. we have such an individualistic view of ourselves and things. So, I mean, this is getting esoteric, I know, and I understand that this is not necessarily what the podcast is about, but, like, this is part of my take is, like, and there may be some other countries included in this, like Australia and Canada maybe would be included in this too, is, like, we have this really individualistic view of our personal liberties and our personal data. And so, therefore, you're scanning my iris and having a record of my iris is an intrusion on my person on my personhood, my sovereignty, if you will. And I don't think that's a thing that people in Europe have as much, you know, and I'm making a big assumption here, and I don't think it's universally true, right? Like I'm not into superlatives where like all Americans feel this way and all the Europeans feel this way. I'm sure that's not the case. I just think in kind of a general blanket sense, I think there's more Americans that have a feeling like that. And there's fewer Europeans that have a feeling like that. And so, you know, I think that's part of where it comes from with biometrics. It's funny because I've never had an issue with it. You know, I let all the data centers, of course, require me to have biometrics, and I've been in a ton of them. They all have my fingerprints, and I'm kind of like, I don't really care. You know, and I'm like on the CLEAR program at the airport so I can get through security really fast. They have my fingerprints. You know, I think it's great. I did TSA pre-check. They have my fingerprints. You know, to me, I'm kind of like, it doesn't bother me that much. You know, if I was a criminal, maybe I'd be concerned about it. But I'm kind of more in that, like, it just doesn't bother me that much. And it provides so much additional security. I'm with you. Like, I think it's a great thing. But I do see both sides of it. Like, those people do have personalized data of me that's directly correlated to me. So I get it. I get both sides.
Yeah, I mean, just to kind of elaborate a little bit more on this, now we're getting really off topic here, but, I mean, I think the thing is, and I've even written an entire book on the psychological, you know, issue of, you know, the slow adoption rate. I think here, you know, this country in the United States, and, you know, and I'm proud to be a U.S. citizen, I'm not, you know, dissing anything, but, you know, we have the, you know, we're counted as individuals in this country, okay? Now, if we're not, you know, we have some kind of legal recourse, but in these poor countries, they don't have that. And giving them the biometric technology, you know, they can be counted as a human being in the eyes of their own, you know, corrupt governments. And another plug-in I want to, you know, put in there is that, you know, I've been in biometrics for a long time, and a question I often get asked is, like, what if my template's hacked into? Well, one, it's just the image is only, it's just the image that's taken, but it's just what's really used, the mathematical representation, the file of that image. Now, that's what's used for, like, for the identification verification. But now, if someone were to steal that, what can they do with it? Nothing. It's not the same thing as a credit card number. So I try to make it that easy for them to understand. So that's something, you know, that I've come across so many times, you know, being in biometrics and even the cybersecurity thing, you know, for, you know, multi-factor authentication and, like, iPhone. You know, I've had people ask me, well, how does the fingerprint reader work? What if I don't want to use it? Well, it's your choice. You don't want to, but it's just going to give you another layer of protection, so...
Yeah.
But anyway, but now back to the cybersecurity threat landscape. Now, I mean, things like ransomware, business email compromise, now crypto mining, crypto jacking are now like the biggest threats out there. Have you done any work with that or any experiences with that?
Well, now we could get on a whole other crazy off-topic thing, but I have a second business called Perforo LLC, and I am a crypto miner. So, I have now I do it completely above board and legally. So don't think I'm jacking my client stuff to mine. I definitely don't do that. It's a totally separate entity. You know, we have equipment in South Dakota with a hosting company. We have like almost 5 petahash of hash against. If you're familiar with Bitcoin, I mean, you would know that's like 0.01% of the network, which is a pretty decent chunk, you know, for a small shop. And so, yeah, I'm a huge believer in cryptocurrency as a concept. Of course, crypto jacking is a huge problem and is a crime. You know, I don't think that's an appropriate way for people to be using other people's computer resources. But yeah, just on a side note, I have a lot of experience with it because I do it, and I think I understand. You know, I think cryptocurrency is the future, and I think it's it should and does have a lot of value. But yeah, I mean, at the same time, we have dealt with ransomware. We have only had one of the hijacked crypto mining systems. But I mean, we see that stuff coming around now. You know, one of the big holes we're working on plugging with our clients is OpenRDP. I mean, that's become the new pathway that people are getting in, is they're brute forcing OpenRDP. And you know, that's been something we've done for a long time for clients. And you know, we've tried to build security and privilege access around that. That's relatively secure, strong passwords, disabling passwords over time, blah 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 blah. But inevitably, you know, what I think I've realized, too, because of this is there's always some user or service account that's been granted remote desktop rights that has a weak password or has been granted an exception. And, you know, the honest truth, and maybe I shouldn't say this on, like, the podcast, but, like, I swear to you, half the time it's, like, the CEO or the CFO or the COO, because they're the ones that can pull weight, right? They're the ones that can say, I don't want a complex password, and I don't want to ever change it. It's my business. I mean, what can you say to that? You can say, like, that's a huge risk. You shouldn't do that. You have access to, like, almost everything on the network with your user account. But if they say it and they're willing to sign off on it, and I have a record of them saying, I understand the risks, do it, and we do it, you know, it's like that they just became a huge risk factor for themselves, and they don't even realize it. You know, we did a dark web. We had one client recently get hit with ransomware, and I can't validate with 100% certainty that this is true, but we did a dark web scan after the fact, complimentary for them just to be nice. And sure enough, the CEO's logon had been – it was not a complex logon. Is a logon he'd used in multiple locations, which is a bad practice, we know. You know, and it's just, you know, I don't want to blame, you know, I don't want to put it on that CEO, but it's just like, it's, you know, we would never let a rank-and-file employee do that stuff. We would just say, no, you have to have a complex password. It has to change every 90 days or 60 days or whatever the requirement is. It has to be 12 characters. Can't be the same as the last 10 passwords you've used. All that stuff that we, like, require. There's no way. And then if they were like, I'm going to complain, go ahead, complain. We'll talk to the CEO and we'll shoot you down. But then when the CEO says, I understand the risks, do it anyway, for them, they become this huge risk factor. I don't know if you've seen this, but I've seen it many times. The CEO or president thinks he's not a big deal. He's not a big risk, and he wants his life to be easier, he or she. And it's just like, yeah, you just created this monstrous open hole for yourself. You know, you're using this crappy password for 5 years, and then sure enough, it got hacked. You know, it got hacked, and you just, you know, and then you're going to complain to me that it was our fault that we didn't protect your system. So, yeah, it's a challenge, you know. And I think we've only seen clients with one direct attack. So, and what I mean by that is we've only had one client that's had a targeted attack where they were specifically targeted for ransomware. They got hit with a really, really nasty stream of ransomware. It was not generic, out of the box like ransomware as a service stuff. This person had built a PowerShell script, ran it at a very specific time, like 1 a.m. local time. Like, they had done their homework and they did the most amount of damage humanly possible in the amount of time they had before we caught it. So even though it was the middle of the night our time, we responded in 60 minutes. But still, it had done so much damage in 60 minutes. It was unbelievable. And so that was a really unique case because it was targeted. You know, it was a hack. It was like a legitimate hacker, which was a really unique first time. And actually, we hired a cybersecurity company and to assist us, and they were shocked because the attacker, you know, they were writing through like a privatized email account, you know, of course through VPN and all this kind of stuff, but we were writing back and forth to them. He's like, I've never seen a hacker, you know, most of the time is these hackers, when you've dealt with them, because we've dealt with regular generic off the shelf ransomware here and there, and you know, it's like, we want 2 Bitcoin. And it's like, no, we'll give you 1. 1.5. Okay, we'll settle on 1.5 and we pay it. Or, you know, no, we've got backup. Screw you guys. We're not paying you anything. Right? So this guy, he wrote in prose. I mean, it was like a 4-paragraph email. Like, you don't know how hard it is in my country. Like, I don't do this illegal work for fun. It's the craziest email I've ever received from one of these things. And it was definitely a really interesting experience to see a client get a targeted attack and not just one of these generic ransomware as a service threats, which are usually pretty easy to mitigate, you know, using backup and recovery. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah, that was pretty crazy. So, yeah, we've had some recent experience with that stuff, unfortunately. And, you know, that's one of the reasons we're rolling out a lot of new security services. We're doing a big 2FA push this year. I'm kind of sick and tired. It's no fun to deal with, you know, so we can mitigate a huge portion of the risk. So that's what we're kind of working on, is getting people 2FA'd, getting OpenRDP closed, getting VPN for everybody required, you know, no open ports, just to reduce that ransomware risk landscape.
Okay. Well, it's interesting you talk about the C-level. Now, one thing that I've written about and one thing that we're going to keep hearing about is the C-suite. And I know this is kind of off topic again. You know, there's always a thought that the C-level, the CISO or the CAO should be held ultimately accountable, and that his head should roll, his or her head should be, you know, chopped off, literally speaking, but or they should be fired if there's a major security breach, blah, blah, blah. But what are your thoughts about this? Because it's going to be a big issue this year, you know, holding C-suite more accountable. I mean, my view is, yes, the C-suite is responsible ultimately, and the buck stops with them. But I think the whole company, every employee, you know, that's involved should be held responsible, right? It's not just one person. What are your thoughts?
Right. Yeah, I mean, I agree. It's not just one person. I think the problem as I was describing it, at least, I think, is that the C-suite treats themselves as special and overrules our own security access protocols, right? So you're asking a question that I think you're right. It's psychological, and I don't know how to fix it. Like,
right.
I don't know how to tell one of my customers, the owner who pays my bills, that I'm not going to do what he's requesting, even though I've explained the risks.
Right.
I, you know, that's hard. I don't know what else to say. It's just,
it's
tricky.
It's a whole different topic. You know, I mean, I've had a lot of, you know, kinds of feedback, but we'll keep that for a later time. Now, going back to your customers, do you have any success stories that you like to share, or any testimonials or case studies that you like to kind of bring about?
That's interesting. You know, the most fun ones to talk about. I mean, of course we have a lot of success stories to talk. We could talk about. We've had clients that have grown really rapidly with us. We had a web app company that went from 14 employees to, 300 employees over the course of 6 years. And we were able to grow and expand with them. And then unfortunately, but you know, it wasn't our fault. It wasn't for lack of bad service. They were purchased by a Chinese company, and the Chinese company wanted to do it their way. And, you know, they give us the boot, but you know, that's just business. That stuff happens. So a little bit disappointing because they had become a big customer of ours. But at the same time, I understand, you know, I mean, congratulations to the ownership of that firm. They did a great job and made a lot of money. So I'd say the biggest wins have actually been with legacy clients. I think those are the ones that are the most interesting. So, like, what? Kind of the ones I've described, like are the industrial clients, you know, the food manufacturing company and the couple of chemical manufacturers. They're old businesses, right? 50, 60, 70-year-old businesses, right? So they've been through so many permutations of software and technology. You know, these are companies that started on paper ledgers, right? You know, and then they're in their second generation of management, right? The sons are middle aged. The original founders are probably, you know, long gone, and you know one of the sons is like in his 70s, right? And I think he's looking to potentially sell the business in the next 5 years or so. But he's very healthy, but still running the business. You know, of course, the father's long gone, and these are just their old legacy businesses, right? So they literally started with paper ledgers, paper systems, moved into really basic technology systems, you know, maybe even AS400s or who knows what back in the day. And then, you know, eventually either chose Novell or Microsoft, and then eventually everybody moved to Microsoft, and then they've kind of moved through the ranks over time. And then they had a legacy ERP system, and then they moved into one of the more common ERP systems now. So now, you know, they might be running Microsoft Dynamics or SysPro or, you know, something like that. You know, Microsoft Dynamics being the most interesting because that's something you could move to the cloud fairly easily. But, you know, they might still have these ERP systems that are so nested in the organization, and they're big companies. You know, they're 200 to 500 person shops, depending on if you include all the warehouse workers and all that kind of stuff, you know. So change is very expensive, right? You talk about moving, you know, our 500 person food manufacturing company to 100% cloud ERP system. That's realistically, that's probably like $1 million project, right? So, And it's not $1 million because the cloud ERP will cost $1 million. It's not even $1 million because the consulting around the cloud ERP will cost $1 million. But just the total cost of the change for all the employees, all the training time, downtime, probably running both systems simultaneously for a month because it's a big business, maybe having some errors related to billing and whatever. You know, I mean, it's expensive and very, very challenging to make a big move like that. And so I'm sure they will eventually. And that's why I say that, you know, these hybrid systems, I think, for legacy companies are going to be around for a while. They don't have any current pain, right? Their ERP system's working, generally speaking, for them. And so, you know, but the ERP system's an on-premise system. So, you know, I think it's going to take time for them to go 100% cloud. But you were asking specifically for a case study of a success story. So here's the case study. So they had a outsourced IT company and two in-house IT people. They were spending about, let's say with burdened IT employees in the firm, you know, they were spending probably close to $250,000 a year on IT support. And the IT service company, because they were a third party and they had in-house IT support as well, you know, they completely oversold. They completely oversold this poor company. Like, I feel bad for the guy. He didn't know what he was, you know, he didn't know enough to vet the thing they were getting. And when they could have spent probably $80,000 or $90,000 on hardware equipment, they spent $300,000, right? You know, now this guy's, the company's doing fine and it wasn't like a major financial hit or anything like that. And it's good equipment. It's not like the equipment's bad. It's just completely oversold. It's like way too big for what they need, right? So now he's got these huge support contracts because of the hardware of all of us. So now we're talking about like, well, okay, when is it going to make sense to not pay these support contracts and just replace the hardware with more reasonably sized hardware for your organization, right? So, but this is a huge win because now he has a trusted party in there. We cost less per month than he was paying before. We provide better service. We come with a lot of other services that weren't happening, you know, patch management, antivirus, all this other stuff that comes with it. We're more trusted. So, you know, he trusts us to make the right calls, not oversell them, all that kind of stuff. So when it does come time to do this new building, you know, he trusts us. He trusts us that we're not going to rip him off and we're going to sell him the right stuff. And that trusted third party, like that's where you really feel like a virtual CTO or virtual CIO is, where you can be in those meetings like, hey, I'm going to spend $5 million on a new building and IT is going to be $300,000 of that. You know, what do I need and what's the most cost-effective stuff? And I need surveillance and access control and cabling and this stuff and that stuff. Okay, cool. Let's talk about that and to have trust there. And, you know, whereas the former IT service provider, not only was he paying all this money per month, you know, probably would have been like, oh, you got to spend $1 million and you got to get all this stuff, right, that he doesn't really need. We're able to come in and provide the right size solution for his business and save him money, in addition to the money we're saving him per month. And in addition to the fact that his employees are happier, he's happier, the systems are working better. Like, oh, it's just everything is better and he's saving money. Like, how you can't get better than that, right? It's like he has a trusted IT provider, everything's working better, and he's spending less money. Like, that's a win. That's a huge win, and everybody's happy. And we're making money on it. And so everybody's happy. That's a win-win-win-win all the way around. And that's the kind of – I believe business can be like that, right? I think sometimes people view business as too cutthroat. And when we can come in – you know, of course, I guess it was a loss for that one IT company and for those employees that had to find new jobs, you know. But overall, like, for the other 500 people that work there and for the owner, this was a huge win all the way around. And that's a huge success story. We have a very similar story with our chemical manufacturing companies that are older companies. These legacy companies, I think we can come in and just do a really fantastic job with and really crush it. So those are great, great case studies. So I think, even with young fast growth companies, I think we can be a huge win because we take that burden of, we take, again, the burden of trust and the burden of fast growth off of them. So, you know, as they need additional employees, well, they don't have anybody on staff that's appropriately skilled to hire IT people. We know how to hire IT people. So now when they need another staff person to meet their requirements, or we need another staff person to meet their growing requirements, we know how to hire the right type of people in-house. So, you know, that's the problem of these legacy firms had, is they had hired people that stunk, but they were paying them regular IT salaries for LA, and they were paying them anywhere between $65,000 and $100,000 a year, you know, and they weren't good. You know, fine. If they were good, I'd be like, well, that's one thing, right? But they weren't good because nobody was qualified to make that hire, right? And you and I have both seen a lot of IT people that just kind of know computers well, and they're not like real Oh, whoops. Sorry, my daughter dropped the iPad. You know, they're just not real IT people. They're just computer folks. So,
right.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Now, what are your general plans for expansion for VStructure? Are you going to offer new services, new products, or perhaps new markets, entry points, or a combination of both?
Not new markets at this time. You know, I think the LA market is definitely not full. There's a lot of in-house IT here still, shockingly, and there's also quite a few, just in my opinion, not great MSPs. There's been a lot of M&A going on in LA recently, and we've been picking up business from some of these growing firms. You know, I don't want to name names, but well, I guess one name I would name are the copier manufacturers. So like, ConocoMinolta and Sharp have been coming in and buying MSP firms. But I won't name, you know, specific other MSPs that have just been doing M&A internally as a growth. You know, I get offers every week to sell my company. And I'm not even joking. Probably once a week I get an offer to sell my company. And it's not because my company's so amazing or so big or so different or whatever. People are just doing roll-ups, right? They're just straight up doing company roll-ups. And that's a strategy for growth and sale because they want to – like my company's not going to get a huge multiple because we're not that huge, right? Whereas if you have a $12 million or $15 million 50-person MSP, you can get maybe a 6 or 7X multiplier, right? So people are just straight up doing roll-ups to get that larger multiple. And so if you have the cash, right, like if you're a VC company or a wealth management company and you have $10 million and you go and buy four smaller MSPs that rolls up to $12 million and got the executive management team to make it more profitable and get a 6X multiple on that, and you only paid 3X for the multiple, you can double your money in like 3 years, right? And you can sell that thing for $20 or $30 million up from your 10 original start. I see this happening a lot in LA. The problem is it creates disruption in those firms, and then the customers get unhappy. So we're picking up a lot of clients. They know exactly what they want. This is a new thing. This is in the last 2 or 3 years, because 12 years ago, I was trying to explain what managed services was and what the advantages were. Now, not all, but like half of our leads are like, we have an existing MSP. This is what happened. They got bought by Sharp. I'll use them because they're a big company. I don't care. But like, you know, they got bought by X. they stink now, or we're not satisfied with the service and we're looking for why, right? And they know exactly what they want. They want what they used to have, and we're not selling out. And that's one of the questions they ask is, are you guys planning to sell anytime soon? And the answer is no. So, you know, I think there's an opportunity for us to keep growing organically into a larger MSP as long as we don't do that through M&A or roll-ups like a lot of other people are doing. And I think there's the ability to take business away from those companies that are doing roll-ups. I've seen this. I have a buddy in Arizona that works for an MSP that was doing similar stuff, and they've shrunk, which is the opposite of what you want when you're doing a roll-up. Because their customers were leaving in droves because they were unhappy. So, you know, the concept of the roll-up can work, but you got to execute really, really well on that roll-up. So it's not as simple as I think these VC people think they are. But, you know, because I think people do have success with them. It's not a 0% success rate, right? People do have success, but when they don't succeed, now you've got a trove of unhappy MSP customers looking for an alternate MSP. And when you search for IT Support Los Angeles or IT Service Los Angeles, we've worked very hard on our SEO. We come up number two, number three in most of those terms. You know, they call us looking exactly for that. You know, our MSP LA, IT MSP LA, Los Angeles. We come up in those top few search results, and people call us and they're like, I know exactly what I want. And I know roughly what I want to pay for it. What do you charge? They don't even really want to have a deep conversation like they did before. I'm unhappy. This is what I want to do. But yes, our goal is to grow. We want to keep growing. I think one of the value propositions there for us that's a differentiating factor is we have no intention of selling. We're we're owner led and managed. Our owner's a technician. We're a tech based company. We're not a sales based company. And I think some of that support that people aren't getting now because of the M&A stuff that's happening in LA, we're still that shop. We're that shop that you want. So, you know, come over to us.
You're
if
right.
you got rolled up into somebody and you're not happy, we're that opportunity to get what you used to have. So
that sounds awesome, yeah. Now, to the kind of segueing to a more macro level, not to the cyber threat
yeah.
landscape,
yeah.
How do you foresee it changing or evolving? Because, you know, I asked this to all my guests, and I've written stuff about it. You know, when the year started, I've written stuff how 2019 will look like. But what are your thoughts? I mean, I keep hearing things that, you know, AI and ML are going to be the big buzzwords. You know, it can be used for both the good and the bad and so forth and so forth. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think, you know, I don't know. I'm not necessarily a good future predictor on this. I think you'd probably agree with me that one of the things that's changed a lot since the 90s over the last few decades is I think in the 90s, people were writing viruses and malicious software just to see if they could do it. You know, it was kind of like a game almost. It was like they were coders, they were young guys or gals trying to figure out how this stuff works, and you know, like, oh my gosh, I got into this system. And a lot of these people went on to be really successful developers in the regular world, right? They didn't necessarily have malintent. It was a little bit like teenagers gone awry, right? It's like when you were 13, maybe you stole a pack of bubble gum from a gas station, right? You're not a vandal and a thief, right? It's just like, it's just kids kind of doing stuff. It's like, you know, and it doesn't necessarily reflect that you're, you know, your permanent character, right? I mean, this is the conversation we have in the social media landscape too, is like kids now are putting everything online. And like, as an adult, you and I know very well that, you know, not everything we did when we were under 18, we want online. Like, we're not necessarily proud of it. That's part of growing up, is you make mistakes and you learn from them, right? So,
yeah.
You know, it doesn't mean I'm a thief or vandal or whatever. It's like, no, we've made mistakes. Like, we learned from them. That's part of growing up. That's part of being a child and learning things. And, you know, so, you know, I think one of the things that's really interesting is now, instead of just seeing malicious software for malicious software's sake, it's become very clear that, like, people have 100% profit motivation in the last 5 to 10 years, right? It's gone from, can we do something? This is interesting. This isn't, you know, and then going on to a professional career to how can I exploit these systems to make money, right? And did some of that go on before? Sure. You know, you even have the old phishing things where people were racking up international telephone bills and all that kind of stuff for profit and things like that. But, you know, it's not that it's never occurred, but it's occurring almost exclusively. Like the phishing attacks we see, the ransomware stuff, the mining, the crypto mining hijacking stuff, all that is solely profit-based. Nobody cares about just trying to do things, right? It's just, can I make money doing this? And I think especially because the globe has become so connected via the internet, whereas in the 90s and even the early 2000s, the internet was still very rudimentary. You know, now it's so interconnected. Like, the world is really, truly connected by the internet. Every home,
right,
and every business has one, if not multiple, internet connections that are on 24/7, 365. There's all these devices. I mean, my house is like the poster child example. You know, I mean, I have more devices than I have people by a long shot, right? You know, me and my wife, we have a Kindle, we have a laptop, we have an iPad, we have a phone for each of us, right? And an Apple Watch, and like, we have, you know, it's like we have like five devices a person, and then we have like a security system, and we have an Apple TV, and we have a printer, and I have a VoIP phone, and we, you know, when you add up all the devices, you're like, oh my gosh, like my Fuji camera connects to the Wi-Fi, like, the amount of things that are just connected on the net is just unreal, right? And it's growing. Like, our fridge isn't connected, but who knows? The next fridge we buy probably will be, right? Like, our thermostats are internet connected. Like, you know, you see just this, the world is just becoming so connected. So the ability to do this kind of stuff is changing. And so I don't know. I think the thing that's been surprising to me has been the 100% pure profit motivation, I think. And I think that's coming out of, you know, the sad situation that a lot of the globe is in, right? Like, I don't think you're seeing people execute these attacks from rich nations for the most part, right? They're not executing these attacks from Australia or Western Europe or Japan or North America. They're doing these attacks from Africa, Eastern Europe, you know, the Eastern Bloc, et cetera. They're poor. And they're like, I can make $100,000 by attacking this company in the United States, right? It's still illegal, and it still has some risk. It doesn't have nearly as much risk as somebody in the United States doing it, right? I think they're generally coming from countries that don't have extradition rights to the United States, so that even if they came looking for you, they can't do anything. And I think, secondly, they're smart. Like, they know, hey, if I only exploit this company for $10,000 or $40,000, the FBI is not even going to do anything. You know, if I exploit Sony for $5 million, they're going to come looking for me, right? So somebody's going to come looking for me. But if I exploit this small business for $40,000, nobody's going to do anything. They know that. They know that. So I don't know. I think the risk is very, very, very real. It's 100% profit motivation. And, you know, what used to be what they called script kiddies, you know, younger guys and gals just running scripts to see if they can get into stuff. I mean, I see it on my firewall at home all the time, just being an advanced user. You know, I have an IDS and IPS on my firewall. It's kind of crazy when you watch what comes just all from all over the globe, especially from those parts of the world. You know, I'm just on a cable modem at home, but, like, I mean,
wow.
The stuff that comes in is crazy, right? You see attacks. You see what appears to be malicious code bot kind of stuff running, right? Like, I saw the other day on my thing, I saw, you know, they scanned like 700 ports on my firewall. Now, my firewall rejected them all because I have an advanced firewall at home, which most users don't have, but I also have the ability to see that and visualize it, and I'm like, wow, that's so interesting. I do it mostly because I think it's really interesting to look at, not because I don't have any open ports at home per se, but, like, you know, it's At our clients' businesses, this is happening probably even more so because they have static IP blocks, they have fiber connections, and, you know, yeah, we're running IDS and IPS and all this kind of stuff, but it's the ability for that to intersect all this stuff has a limited basis, right? They do have open ports, and the whole point of this stuff is to find open ports, find vulnerabilities, and I think these guys out there are just running these programs, and they're just sleeping at night, and they wake up in the morning and get a report. And it's like, hey, we found three open things we can get into. Oh, okay, cool. They jump in. They look at those companies. They see if they think they can exploit them. If they can, they try to. And that's like, it's just, you know, it's 100% profit motivation, and it's not that hard, sadly. And so companies need to be protected against that stuff. So, you know, as far as looking into the future, I'm not sure. Like, I think that's happening right now. I don't know what the future holds. I think it's going to be probably more the same. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, that kind of brings me on to another topic here. It's called the Internet of Things, since you elaborated so much on the last one. I find the IoT a very, very scary thing. I don't want any connections except me to my iPhone. I don't want to have this world where everything's all connected, because if, I mean, not only does increase the attack service for the cyber attacker, but if one thing breaks down, there's a cascading effect. And, like, my financial advisor, I met him maybe a few weeks ago for lunch. I mean, this guy has, like, a smart card, literally with the clasp of his hands, car backed out of the parking lot. And it's like, damn, like, you know, that car wouldn't survive, you know, sub-zero temperatures here in Chicago. I mean, what if one electronic wire got frozen? I mean, the whole car is gone. So what are your thoughts on the Internet of Things? I think it's a very scary thing. I mean, I know it's meant to automate our lifestyle, but it's very scary, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think people need I I think there just needs to be additional protect. The hard part is the user training part of this, right? So, like, if you look at my setup at home, I don't have any of the bad behaviors that cause a lot of other people strife and risk, right? I have for my firewall and like I have security cameras, but I don't send them to the cloud. I have a local recorder. Like, my local recorder has a super, super complex password. But I do have, like, internet cloud-connected thermostats, you know. But, you know, even I've been thinking, and I've been lazy about actually completing it. It's like, I want to build a separate Wi-Fi network just for the – and isolate the IoT stuff from my regular network. And I haven't done that yet. So, but that's kind of on – that's been on my to-do list, is to isolate all that equipment into its own Wi-Fi network. But, you know, I think the number one thing that people are just really bad about is they just leave default passwords on stuff. And I feel less like I'm a risk factor, because the difference between, like, me, for example, and my smart home, and my home's not even, like, super smart, but, like, you know, the stuff that I've done, like thermostats or whatever, nothing has default passwords on them. And to me, you know, so many people install, for one, really, really cheap garbage equipment, right? They go buy, I mean, I don't want to name manufacturer names. So they just go, they go to Fry's Electronics and Best Buy and just buy some really, really, really cheap thing, which is maybe fine, but it probably has security flaws. They don't keep the software up to date, and then they don't change the default password. And so those two behaviors over time create a massive security risk. You know, for me, I keep all my software up to date on all my stuff. I have very, very, very complex passwords on everything because I use a password manager. That's another thing that, I mean, everybody, I have tried so hard to get my parents and my in-laws to use a password manager. I have spent hours trying to show them and teach them how to use a password manager. I cannot get them to use it. I can't get them to use it. It's just, like, mind-boggling to me, but it's true. And so I'm less worried about myself because, it, to me, I describe it to people like, you know, if a thief is walking down the street and they're going to break into a car, let me give you three scenarios. And which car do you think they're going to break into? Okay, car number one is locked and there's nothing visible inside. Car number two is locked and there's a laptop on the passenger seat. Car number three is unlocked or the windows are rolled down and has $10,000 of cash sitting on the passenger seat. You think they're going to break the window to get the laptop, or you think they're just going to reach in and grab the 10 grand, right? Everybody's going to just reach in and grab the 10 grand. Right now, if that car wasn't there, you would break the window to grab the laptop before you break into a car that has nothing visible, right? Because you don't know what's in there. So why take the risk of committing a crime if you don't know what you're going to get? So, you know, it's, to me, I'm not an attack vector because I'm the car that has nothing visible and has my locks up. Like, I'm locked. And so, you know, the guys that are going to get hit, or guys and gals are going to get hit, the families that are going to get hit are the ones that bought cheap stuff, everything's visible on the internet, they don't update their software, they have default passwords. Literally, they have left their car keys unlocked. Like, they have a car that's unlocked, and it's just, it's money sitting on the passenger seat. And eventually, some guy will run a script, find the entryway, get in, and do something. So I'm with you. IoT is scary, but IoT is only scary if you're the person that that put the least amount of effort into keeping your environment secure, in my opinion.
Yeah.
There's 7 billion people on the globe.
Yeah, I don't want to get involved in an IoT thing. It's just, I have an old Honda Civic in 03. You know, just analog instrumentation for me, that's good enough. It survived some winters here in Chicago. But when I saw my financial advisor, James Bond car, I was going, Jesus, things gotten crazy. I mean, seriously, had like three screens on his dashboard, and it was just too much for me to. Anyway, well, Chad, we got time for one more question here. We got like 5 minutes left in the show, so I want this to be the last one here. I get this asked a lot, and so I ask my guests. What do you recommend for people and businesses to do to protect themselves from a cyber attack or being a victim? What are your top two or three things?
Top three things are...
Or whatever. I mean, we have like 5 minutes left, so just, you know, with that time constraint in mind, just tell me, like, what do you tell people? You know, when you go visit a customer, like, what's your generic list?
The number one thing is the easiest thing. You know, it tends to be... It's complex passwords, requiring your employees to have complex passwords, enforcing that they're changed. You know, just it seems like the most silly, basic little thing, but doing a user account audit and requiring strong passwords of every single person makes a dramatic difference and requires virtually no money. Will it maybe irritate some of your users? Yes, but like, it's so easy and fast, and it makes a monstrous difference in your level of security. So that's the first thing I'd say is, like, that's your first line of defense, right? Your second line of defense, I think, is 2FA. I think 2FA is very important. It's a hard sell, but I think it's a sell people got to have. And I think 3 is a bit general, but it's taking a layered security approach, right? So you have to have multiple things. You have to have antivirus, anti-malware, a firewall, maybe 2 firewalls, but an advanced next-gen firewall that has IDS and IPS and capture ATP and all these things. You have to use Maps and Windows Defender. And, you know, I could just list and list and list on a whole bunch of things. None of them are terribly expensive, right? Yeah, but it's security by layering. Right, no one of those things is going to protect you from everything. And in fact, all those things are not going to protect you from everything. But by implementing a layered, multifaceted security approach, you can get very secure pretty quickly. So those are kind of my top three things: this systems-based layered security, 2FA, and then something just super basic, but most organizations are not doing it, is complex passwords require them to change. Make everybody do it. Do a user account audit. Just right there, you're going to clean up a huge security hole for almost every organization out there.
Well, Chad, we're coming up here close to a couple of minutes here left for the show. I just want to tell you thank you so much for your time today, especially coming up on a weekend here. Thanks for your time, and we look forward to having another conversation with you here, maybe more on the social implications of cybersecurity. I think we'll get another great podcast on that down the road here. So I just want to tell you once again, thanks for your time.
Yeah, thank you so much. Thanks for having me on. It's been really fun. And I definitely, we went down a couple rabbit holes I think we could have spent a bunch of other time down. So, I find that stuff fascinating and definitely would be interested in having a conversation specifically related to any one of those.
Definitely.
So.
Definitely. Yep. It sounds good. We'll talk to you soon then. Take care.
Great. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.